Good afternoon. Welcome to the Amherst Telephone Lecture Series. I'm Betsy Cannon-Smith, Class of 84, Alumni Secretary here at the college, and sitting in Professor Goldsby's beautiful office overlooking the Amherst playing fields in the Life Sciences Building. It's my pleasure to welcome you, and we're pleased to literally have folks on the call from all over the world, a number of Professor Goldsby's past students among you. Professor Goldsby is the Thomas B. Walton, Jr. Memorial Professor of Biology here at the college, and he'll be speaking on how stem cells will change your life and maybe save it. Professor Goldsby has been a professor at Amherst College since 1982. A specialist on the immune system, he is the author of many scientific papers, and with Thomas Kent and Barbara Osborne, the author of the sixth and two previous editions of Kubi Immunology, a widely used textbook. Other books include Cells and Energy, Race and Races and Thinking AIDS, with Mary Catherine Bateson. In 1998, with other colleagues, he co-founded Hematech, a biotech startup that created the first cloned transgenic cattle capable of producing human antibodies. He holds a BA in chemistry from the University of Kansas and a PhD in chemistry from the University of California at Berkeley. This year, his course offerings include The Biology of Catastrophe, Cancer and AIDS, and The Cell and Molecular Biology of Cancer. A recording of this call will be posted on the alumni website later this week, so pass it along to your friends who missed it. Supplemental reading suggested by Professor Goldsby can also be found on the alumni website. We welcome your feedback and hope you'll join our next call on November 17th with Maria Heim, Associate Professor of Religion, whose topic will be Buddhist Inquiries into Love and Friendship. To submit a question during the call, some of which we've already received, please send an email to alumseries, that's A-L-U-M-S-E-R-I-E-S, alumseries at amherst.edu. And after Professor Goldsby's remarks, we'll try to get to as many of your questions as possible. Professor Goldsby, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to hearing this talk.
And thank you, Betsy, and thanks for this opportunity to hold a kind of a conversation with Extramural Amherst. This afternoon, we're going to be talking about stem cells. And stem cells are cells that can turn into other cells. This is a simple notion, but as we'll see, it turns out to be a very powerful one. Maybe I ought to give an example, a rather spectacular example of something that's happened in stem cell biology. Perhaps the most familiar application of stem cell biology dates back to March of 1996, when a team of scientists at Scotland's Roslin Institute announced the creation of Dolly, the first cloned mammal. This was much more than just technical dazzle. It was an epical achievement that brought stem cells, stem cell biology, and stem cell politics into our consciousness and into the news where it's remained. Now, to make Dolly, the Roslin team took an unfertilized egg from a sheep, removed its nucleus, the storehouse of its DNA, and they replaced this original nucleus with a different one, one taken not from another egg cell, but taken from a fully differentiated sheep cell. The genetic information of this borrowed nucleus provided the blueprints necessary to make Dolly. And with this bombshell, the Roslin group demonstrated for the first time that under the right circumstances, the nucleus of a fully differentiated cell can be reprogrammed to specify the development of a creature. Furthermore, the new creature was genetically identical to the animal that donated the nucleus, and therefore it was a clone of this nuclear donor. So for the first time, it was possible to clone mammals. Stem cell biology has remained in our attention, and we want to talk about this remarkable category of cells today. But as we get started, I want to emphasize that there's not just one kind of stem cell, but there are actually many different kinds of stem cells, and let's just go down the roster of different sorts of stem cells. The Dolly experiment employed the most versatile stem cell known, the fertilized egg. The fertilized egg, also known as the zygote, is a single cell that can give rise to all of the 220 some odd different cell types that we find in the body. And in addition, fertilized egg can also generate a placenta. This is an indispensable organ, absolutely necessary for the nourishment of the developing fetus. Because fertilized eggs can make the totality of cells necessary to make an organism, this type of stem cell is called totipotent. Let's move down one rung to the next cell type in the hierarchy of different sorts of stem cells. Early in the course of development, just 5 days after fertilization in a human, a different population of stem cells, known as embryonic stem cells, appear in the embryo. Although an embryonic stem cell cannot make a placenta, it can give rise to all of the 220 different kinds of cells that make up the body. Embryonic stem cells are called pluripotent. They're not totipotent because, unlike a fertilized egg, they lack the ability to generate a placenta. So even though they are quite versatile, they're certainly of lower pay grade than fertilized eggs, which are totipotent. Embryonic stem cells, ESL cells as they're called for short, are endowed with the ability to give rise to all the body's different types of cells, and because they can be readily grown in the laboratory, embryonic stem cells are of extraordinary interest to basic biology, and everyone thinks they're going to be of great importance to regenerative and remediative medicine. However, we have to bear in mind that embryonic stem cell lines can only be derived from human embryos, and the process of deriving these lines, of course, results in the destruction of the embryo. So because of what has to be done to derive them, these cells have been, from the very beginning, the focus of great political and ethical interest. And from time to time, during our conversation this afternoon, we will return to the political and ethical controversies that have been inspired by human embryonic stem cell research. Let's move down another notch in the stem cell hierarchy and mention yet another class of stem cells, adult stem cells, which will complete our lineup of different stem cell sorts. Adult stem cells have the responsibility for generating and maintaining the many different cell types of the tissues they represent. For example, there are neural stem cells, a type of adult stem cell found in the brain. These cells can generate all three of the brain's major cell types. Another example would be skin stem cells. Skin stem cells are adult stem cells that give rise to cells of the skin and also to hair follicles. But by far, the best known adult stem cell is the blood stem cell, a cell technically known as the hematopoietic stem cell. Blood stem cells generate all of the body's red and white blood cells. As key to the life of the body as adult stem cells are, it's important to be aware that although an adult stem cell can generate all of the cells of its own tissue or organ type, it cannot give rise to cells and tissues different from its own cell or tissue type, its own organ or tissue type. Adult stem cells are typically multipotent, able to give rise to a variety of cells of a particular category. We've mentioned skin, nerve tissue, and we've also talked about blood, and we'll talk about muscle. Therefore, adult stem cells are very different and more limited than their vastly more versatile forebears, pluripotent embryonic stem cells and totipotent fertilized eggs, which, as we've said before, are the ultimate stem cells. So there's the lineup. What kinds of stem cells so far have proven their utility? Well, so far, despite the far greater potential of pluripotent embryonic stem cells, the only stem cell that is routinely used in the clinic is a particular type of adult stem cell, the hematopoietic stem cell. As just mentioned, these adult stem cells give rise to all of the different types of blood cells. the red blood cells that carry oxygen to organs and tissues, and the white blood cells that comprise much of the immune system. It's a system that is essential for protecting us against infection. Bone marrow is the major source of hematopoietic stem cells. And when somebody gets a bone marrow transplant, it's really just the tiny population of hematopoietic stem cells, less than 100% of the cells in the bone marrow, that provide all of the therapeutic benefit. And as you know, so-called bone marrow transplantation has been a feature of clinical practice for many decades, saving and improving the quality of countless lives. Despite the success, though, of bone marrow transplantation, really the transplantation of a particular type of stem cell to regenerate the blood cell population, regenerative medicine is pinning more of its hopes on pluripotent stem cells, such as embryonic stem cells, than it is on adult stem cells. There are two important reasons why this is true. First, embryonic stem cells can make any cell type, including various types of adult stem cells. Second, embryonic stem cells can be grown as pure populations in the laboratory, as in very large numbers outside the body. However, most adult stem cell types can't be readily grown in pure culture to large numbers. And this last point is a very important consideration. It's an important consideration because regenerative medical techniques typically require very large numbers of cells. Unfortunately, the question of how to grow large numbers of most types of adult stem cells outside the body remains a very difficult and yet unsolved problem. But let's turn back now to embryonic stem cells that have been so much in the news. I want you to consider a rather dramatic example of the potential for use in regenerative medicine that this cell type has. Heart attacks and other cardiovascular diseases are the number one cause of death in the United States. And as an increasing portion of the population becomes elderly, heart attacks, as well as other cardiovascular diseases, will remain major representatives of catastrophic disease. Now, everybody knows that heart attacks can severely damage heart muscle. Interesting experiments done in a rat model for the study of heart attack provide a very striking example of how embryonic stem cells might be used in the future to provide replacement cells for the repair of damaged heart muscle, perhaps a way to fix a broken heart. Very interesting experiments were done in the University of Washington's Institute for Stem Cell and Regenerative Medicine. LaFlame and his group, using well-defined culture conditions, induced human embryonic stem cells, human ES cells, to differentiate into heart muscle cells, cells known as cardiomyocytes, in the laboratory. These cells were then injected directly into the infarcted rats that have damage simulating heart attack, the infarcted hearts of rats. Even in the rat heart, strikingly, human embryonic stem cell-derived cardiomyocytes, heart muscle cells, were able to form significant amounts of well-organized and functional heart muscle. Using ingenious, tiny, very ingenious and tiny NMR machine, the investigators could actually show that the injection of these cardiomyocytes contributed to a strengthening and thickening of the walls of damaged hearts. The investigators also made the important observation that the transplanted cells prevented the progression of the test animals to heart failure. This constitutes a further demonstration of the therapeutic effectiveness of human ES cell based treatments. So these experiments are very exciting, but as exciting as they are in an animal model, they're still a very long way from the clinic. A great deal of further research will be necessary before this approach or ones like it will be safe and effective for use in clinical medicine, for use in humans. Just to put this in perspective, I want you to consider that Thompson and his group at the University of Wisconsin announced way back in 1998 that they had succeeded for the first time in deriving human ES cells. But it's only now, 12 years later, that we see the beginning of the first clinical trials of human ES cells. This first trial is being conducted by Geron, a California-based biotechnology company. Geron received FDA approval to begin tests to determine if cells generated from human ES cells will actually be effective for the treatment of spinal cord injury. Now, the initial test they're running is a so-called phase one trial. This is a preliminary test that's intended just to determine the safety of a treatment. However, in spite of that limited aim that the treatment has, there will be an opportunity to make some early assessments of whether patients treated with ES cell-derived cells show improvement in muscle function and show some gain of sensation in areas affected by their spinal cord injuries. So a lot of hard work lies in front of the field before stem cell treatments based on ES cells actually come to the clinic. And beyond the difficult, expensive, and time-consuming studies that are, of course, essential forerunners to the use of human ES cells for therapy, there lie extremely challenging ethical and legal hurdles. It's well known that restrictions on the derivation of human embryonic cell lines have raised barriers that have slowed, and sometimes even halted publicly funded research in the stem cell area. As might be expected, given these hurdles, given these obstacles that come up often unexpectedly, researchers have sought alternatives to the derivation of pluripotent stem cells, alternatives that would not raise the same ethical problems that human embryonic stem cells raise. Just a few years ago, Shinya Yamanaka in Japan made a stunning discovery. He found that the addition of the right combination of just four genes turned mouse skin cells into cells that behave very much like embryonic stem cells. These cells are known as induced pluripotent stem cells, or iPS cells for short. This was a development of enormous importance, and we learned a lot from these experiments. Two of the most important lessons taught by these experiments were these two. First, highly differentiated adult cells, cells that were not even stem cells, could be returned to the state of the pluripotent stem cell. Second, an unexpectedly small number of genes, just four, were all that was required to effect this truly remarkable transformation. Further research showed that this technology is not limited to mice. The Thompson group was the first to extend it to humans, and many others have followed in their footsteps. And what's been found is that adult cells, such as those of skin, have been taken from humans and transformed into human-induced pluripotent stem cells. In the laboratory, these human iPS cells have been made to differentiate into a large number of different types of human cells. In fact, a dozen different kinds have been derived so far. And these include nerve cells, several different sorts of blood cells, and cardiomyocytes, the heart muscle cells we talked about in the earlier experiments on the rat myocardial infarction model that we were talking about just a few minutes ago. And there's reason to believe that techniques will be worked out that will eventually allow conversion of human iPS cells into any of the body's 220 different cell types, any that might be needed for regenerative medicine. So aside from being a scientific breakthrough, induced pluripotent stem cell technology completely bypasses the ethical minefields and the political morasses that have impeded and, in fact, sometimes blocked research on embryonic stem cells. Now, as might be expected, induced pluripotent stem cells have great potential for medicine, especially as disease models and as therapeutic agents. With respect to modeling diseases, cells can be taken from the skin or the blood of somebody afflicted with a particular disease of interest and transformed into iPS cells. In the laboratory, these iPS cells can be converted into large numbers of the kinds of cells underlying the patient's disease. These iPS cells that one is deriving actually give one a petri dish model of that particular patient's disease. And these iPS cell-derived models can be used to learn more about the disease, to identify drugs that might be useful for its therapy, and to begin early tests of the safety of candidate drugs. So with regard to iPS cell-based therapies, animal experiments have actually provided some very striking examples of the potential of this approach. For example, neurons derived from iPS cells have been used to treat a type of Parkinson's disease in a rat model. And hematopoietic stem cells derived from iPS cells have been used to effectively cure sickle cell anemia, a devastating disease, in a mouse model for that disease. So from what's been said so far, it ought to be clear that both iPS cells and ES cells hold great promise. And also, obviously, adult stem cells have already proven their usefulness in terms of the transplantation, as we mentioned earlier, of blood stem cells, hematopoietic stem cells. So each one of these stem cell types has its advantages, and each one has its weaknesses. If we look at embryonic stem cells are fully pluripotent. You don't have to do anything to them. As they're derived, they are fully pluripotent. So without genetic modification, they can be programmed purely by culture conditions to turn into a wide variety of different cell types, and they can be grown in very large amounts outside the body. However, the kinds of cells arising from ES cells are genetically compatible with the donor and individuals who happen to be genetically very close to that donor. But if you're going to put it into another individual, of course, it's a transplant and it carries the same risks of rejection when placed in another individual that any transplant, such as kidney, liver, or heart would carry. With regard to iPS cells, the procedures used to generate iPS cells generally involve adding or inducing the expression of genes that are known to increase the risks of cancer. This is clearly a problem that will have to be solved before cells produced through iPS technologies can be used in therapy. But on the plus side, because iPS cells can be derived from easily available skin or blood cells of the patient for whom the repair cell populations are needed, they will be fully compatible with the patient's immune system, and so one doesn't have to face problems of rejection. Also, as already mentioned, iPS cells can be generated without the need to obtain and destroy human embryos. So which technology should be used? ES cells, iPS cells, adult stem cells? Well, this is still a very young and a very rapidly developing field. And at this stage, no one really knows which technology will be best for a given purpose. It's possible, even likely, that an ES cell line, a particular one, might be very good for regenerating one type of cell, whereas a totally different ES cell line, or maybe an iPS cell line, might be better for another purpose. So the best thing to do, since there are so many unknowns at this stage, and there's the high likelihood that some lines and approaches will be good for one application, whereas other lines and other approaches will be better for a different application, is to pursue all lines. Certainly, we will get the best science, and certainly, we will develop the best treatments if all of the different avenues of stem cell research, embryonic stem cell research, induced pluripotent stem cell research, and adult stem cell research, are all viewed as complementary rather than as alternative. So all of these approaches should be vigorously pursued. Now, in addition to scientific and technical challenges, ethical issues and political controversies have been dominant features of the stem cell landscape. I began our conversation with Dolly and the cloning of mammals. For some, this raised the specter of human cloning. But really, it's become clear for a number of reasons, moral, scientific, and technical, that human cloning is simply not on the table for the American community of scientists. And as this realization has sunk in, worry about and interest in human cloning has retreated into the obscurity it deserves. But the debate over the derivation and use of human embryonic stem cells, whether or not this is morally acceptable, this debate continues. It continues in pulpits. It continues in legislative halls. And as we just saw very recently, it certainly is continuing in the courts. Let's remind ourselves just briefly of the core of the disagreement. Human embryonic stem cells are derived from very early human embryos. Harvesting these cells destroys the embryo. However, bear in mind that the embryos used as sources for human ES cells are excess embryos created in fertility clinics. These are embryos that are destined to be disposed of because they are not needed. Proponents of human embryonic stem cell research take the position that it is better to use these embryos for the advancement of human health than to wastefully send them down the drain. But opponents say that regardless of the circumstances, it is morally wrong to destroy one life for the purpose of benefiting other lives. They go on to say that at the very least, the government should not be in the position of underwriting such an activity with taxpayer dollars. They point out that the work of a scientist who uses human ES cells carries a moral taint. They say this is true even if a particular researcher had nothing to do with the extraction of human ES cells. They argue that because of the immoral derivation of ES cells in the first place, research conducted using them is the immoral fruit of the poison tree. Therefore, the work should not receive government funding, and it should not receive government endorsement. This argument and its political fallout continues to hamper, sometimes quite severely, the work of those conducting stem cell research and development. Going forward, we can be sure that the rapid and dramatic pace of research in molecular and cell biology will continue to present our society with profound ethical questions. And these questions will take the form: having found out we can do something, should we do it? And if we should do it, under what conditions and with what limitations? These are the quandaries that powerful new technologies always present. Given the freedom and the necessary resources, stem cell biology holds the promise to create a new era of regenerative medicine. How it should be done and with what limitations is the quandary that stem cell biology presents to our legislatures, our judges, and to ourselves.
Thank you, Professor Goldsby, and we already have some questions.
So, oh, good.
Let me begin. This is in reference to the talking about the mice, I believe. What is the source of the four genes, and do the resultant redifferentiated cells differ from differentiated cells from embryonic stem cells due to the added four genes?
Yes. The four genes that are used are all genes that produce proteins that are known as transcription factors, master regulatory proteins that can control the expression of whole banks, whole groups of genes. And so if you add just the right four transcription factors, what Yamanaka and his colleagues found was that you could take ordinary skin cells and turn these cells into something that behaved very, very much like embryonic stem cells. And what's the other part of the question, please? Another part.
What were the four genes? I think that was it. And do they result in redifferentiated cells differ from the differentiated cells?
That's a very interesting question. So you can take skin cells, and by adding the right combination of these four factors, you can make them into something that behave very much like embryonic stem cells. But research, a particular research from George Daly's, the laboratory of Dr. George Daly at the Harvard Stem Cell Institute, has shown that even though these cells have turned around and largely become cells that behave a lot like embryonic stem cells, in many cases, they tend to remember their tissues of origin. So there's a little bit of hysteresis involved here, and it remains to be seen whether or not this kind of memory of the cell type of origin will be a problem when one wants to use induced pluripotent stem cells for various therapeutic applications. So this is a matter of research, and we'll have to learn more to see what the ultimate answer turns out to be.
Okay. Ignoring the question of cloning, could rejection issues be reduced by using an adult germ cell, an ova or sperm, to create fertilized cells with 50% of the genes of the adults who will eventually receive the ES cells?
One can actually clone mammals, as the Dolly experiment shows, by actually introducing the nucleus of a more developed cell into an egg. But the business of actually doing that with nuclei from humans and then allowing them to develop into something that one uses, that raises major ethical flags. And stem cell researchers have kind of agreed that they're not going to do that kind of research. There are real limitations on human cloning and the extent to which one can do that. So that's the sort of place that's kind of cordoned off and set aside by a properly placed ethical barriers.
And speaking of animal cloning, you mentioned but didn't say too much about the developments in cloning. Would you tell us more about progress in cloning since Dolly and what its applications might be?
Sure, I'd be glad to. There's been a great deal of activity in cloning animals. In fact, many, many, many different animals have been cloned. People have cloned sheep, of course, with Dolly, but people have cloned cats, mice, pigs, rabbits, and close to our own hearts, people have cloned cows. The first cloned cat, incidentally, was called Copycat, for obvious cute reasons. And in fact, cloning technology has made it possible to reproduce an animal that cannot reproduce on its own. Mules have been cloned, so now the lowly mule, in common with the rest of us, can now reproduce its peculiar species, but it has to be done in the laboratory by cloning. So many animals have been cloned. The uses of cloned animals will range from creation of various types of medicines to creation of animals for food and fiber. How long before we'll be having Dolly for dinner? Well, it's hard to say exactly how long, but what we do know is that the FDA has found no differences in cloned versus uncloned meat, and they have cleared cloned animals for human consumption. So cloned lamb chops may be on the menu before too much longer.
Would you talk a little bit about the implications of the work you're doing with the transgenic cattle and with Hematech and what that might mean?
Many years ago, four of us founded a company called Hematech, Jim Roble, James Barton, my wife Barbara Osborne, and myself. This was a company whose purpose was to take cattle and clone them, but to make cattle that were transgenic for the part of the human immune system that presides over the formation of antibodies, and at the same time to knock out the capacity of these cattle to make cow antibodies. So what was obtained were cows that would make human antibodies but did not make bovine antibodies. And that's a company that we sold to a Japanese pharmaceutical concern back in 2005. And we wish them the best of luck, and we hope that someday it becomes possible to actually treat human patients with human antibodies that were derived from cloned transgenic cattle.
Would you address for a moment the impact of the recent court challenge and injunction regarding stem cell research at the NIH?
Well, as one probably knows, back toward the end of August, Judge Royce Lamberth of the District Court in Washington, D.C., handed down a decision that enjoined the federal government from supporting further stem cell research that was based on human embryonic stem cells. However, this particular injunction was lifted just very recently by a three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals. So things have been allowed to go forward once again. However, the case has not yet, the case originally brought before Judge Lamberth, has not yet been adjudicated. And so even though the stem cell ban has been temporarily lifted by rescinding of the injunction, the particular court challenge still has to be dealt with. Ultimately, this matter is one that's going to have to be addressed by Congress, and it will depend on when Congress addresses this matter in order to get real clarification on what can be done with funding of stem cell research.
Another question. iPS cell technology seems complicated. If you want to make a nerve cell from a skin cell, first you have to change the skin cell to an iPS cell and then change the iPS cell to a nerve cell. Why isn't it possible to just change one cell type directly into another type?
Well, a few years ago, I think I would have answered that question by saying, well, it's people just haven't figured out how to do that yet, but they do know how to take embryonic stem cells or induced pluripotent stem cells and turn those into another cell type. However, science moves ahead very quickly, and just in the past very few years, a couple of years ago, the Melton Group at Harvard succeeded in a spectacular experiment where just by adding a few transcription factors to cells of the pancreas that are not capable of making insulin, they were able to transform those cells into beta islet cells that could make insulin. So in a single process, they were able to take cells of one type and differentiate them into another type. So this kind of trans-differentiation could be done. And very recently, just this year, the group of Marcus Wernig out at Stanford has succeeded in taking skin cells and turning those skin cells directly into nerve cells just by adding the right factors. So now we have added to stem cell technologies using ES cells or using iPS cells or using a type of adult stem cell. One now has to add this process of transdifferentiation.
The Biology of Catastrophe is an intriguing course title. Could you tell us a little bit about that course and its content?
Delighted to. I'll be teaching that course, in fact, in another 50 or 60 minutes this afternoon. Of course, I love teaching. This is a course we offer here at Amherst College for non-majors. We try and keep people majoring in the sciences from taking this course, because what we want to do with this course is introduce people who have, very frankly, probably avoided a number of science courses in their undergraduate careers. And what we do is talk about cancer, and we talk about AIDS, and we talk about the biology behind these diseases, and we integrate and interweave this biology, which is morbidly fascinating, with the social interface of cancer treatment, what cancer does to families, with the AIDS epidemic, what it's done on a socio-political level, and the kind of psychological impacts it has. This course also gives us a chance to talk about other biologies of catastrophe, such as epidemics, like the epidemic of influenza. You know, it's tragic the amount of humans who have suffered and died as a consequence of infection with HIV. But if we look at pandemics throughout history, influenza is probably one of the champion killers around. The last really big pandemic we had, the 1918 one, probably killed 50 million humans. So we take a look at pandemics, and we also take a look at not just natural catastrophes, but we look at man-made or human-inspired catastrophes. You know, bioterrorism and biological warfare is a type of biological catastrophe that is intentionally orchestrated by societies to deliberately kill and maim their fellow human beings. So we talk about that as well.
Can you talk a little bit about some of the research you've engaged in with students over the years and thesis supervision and the kinds of projects and futures those students have gone on to?
Well, I won't get into that too deeply because it will take us quite far afield from stem cell research. But I did have a few students when we had this company, Hematech, who actually did some work on the clone transgenic cows that we use, and we all had great fun with that work. One of those students has gone on to become a veterinarian. Another student has gone on to medical school, and so we've covered a variety of different things, but I think we probably want to keep this conversation focused on stem cell biology.
Which line of stem cells, and you talked about the three ESL, ISP, or adult stem cells, and the various choices one can make in thinking about the future, do you have an opinion on which of these should be pursued most vigorously in the scientific community?
Yes, I do have an opinion, and it's an extremely wishy-washy opinion. Right now, we really don't know which strategy is best. We know that adult stem cells can be used for treatment because hematopoietic stem cells have been curing some diseases and helping patients with other diseases for many, many years now. However, you just can't make a bet that where you're sure that you ought to go with iPS cell technology and abandon ES cell technology or go with ES cell technology and not pay much attention to iPS cell technology. Both these areas have to be pursued. I think if you talk with individuals who are deeply immersed in embryonic stem cell research and iPS stem cell research, what their hope is that ultimately the field will be able to transition to induced pluripotent stem cells and be able to gradually withdraw from the embryonic stem cell because of the ethical minefields that will continue to bedevil researchers who work in those areas. So people are hoping that they'll be able to do everything with iPS cells that they can currently do with embryonic stem cells. But as I said earlier, adult stem cells you're hampered by the fact that you can turn these cells into the cells of a particular organ or tissue, but it's very difficult to get them to become some other organ or tissue. Embryonic stem cells, you have these ethical minefields you have to go through. And with iPS cells, currently the way you make iPS cells involves turning on genes that can predispose cells to cancer.
Turning back in Amherst history a bit, does the work of Oscar Chatte hold any lessons for those working in the development of stem cell therapies? And for those who did not know Professor Chatte, he was a longtime scientist here at Amherst College.
Well, thank you very much for invoking the noble ghost of Oscar Chatte. I knew Professor Chatte. He was a truly remarkable man. He was a gifted embryologist. He had been trained in the laboratory of Spemann, who is the godfather, I would say, of stem cell research, a man who won a Nobel Prize for his terribly important work on early development and how cells commit to one lineage of development as opposed to another. Oscar Achate did very nice work here at Amherst, and he was famous not only for his research, he was also famous as a great teacher. Oscar could actually write with one hand and draw with the other simultaneously. Truly a remarkable figure.
Thank you. Another question. How would you recommend educating the general population about stem cell research in order to break down the resistance to stem cell usage because of inaccurate religious propaganda or an unclear scientific understanding of stem cell research?
I think matters of conscience are matters that we should leave each individual to decide for themselves. After all, I think that's what the United States is based on, that we can all make our own religious determinations, and we should be allowed to do that. It's quite another matter, however, for me to impose my own set of religious beliefs on someone else, and I believe that here in the United States it's inappropriate for someone else to impose those beliefs on me. Certainly, if one wants a religious explanation for what's correct and right and proper with regard to human embryonic stem cells, women and men of the cloth disagree on this ethical issue. So this is an issue that should be a matter of conscience for each individual. This is an issue that we shouldn't drag into the public policy arena in the way that we have done so.
What diseases will benefit most from advances in stem cell research, and who's at the forefront of this research?
Well, there are many groups at the forefront. There are many very powerful organizations that are doing embryonic stem cell research, induced pluripotent stem cell research, and, of course, adult stem cell research. The ones that are kind of first in line, I would say, are those where you kind of have some idea what kind of intervention to make, and these are the interventions of a sort where supplying a competent cell type would be able to replace, to repair the lesion caused by defective cell types. If you get into diseases like Alzheimer's or diseases of that sort where you don't really understand these relationships, probably these are not immediate candidates for stem cell research, whereas perhaps a disease such as difficulties with various white blood cell disorders, where one knows that a patient's problem is a lack of a particular type of white blood cell, this kind of thing, if one could replace that white blood cell now, one could cure the patient. These are the kinds of diseases that are first in line as major candidates for stem cell therapies.
Can you talk a little bit about how collaborative or competitive the process is of all of the researchers working around the world in this stem cell research, and what's your assessment of that? Is it?
Yes, I can. I'd like to talk about that at two levels. First, just the relationship among different laboratories working in a field, and secondly, relationships between different countries in the world. First of all, one of the lifeblood of science is the fact that you have a number of different individuals working on the same problem, taking different approaches, each laboratory eager to get to the goal of finding out how nature works in this particular arena, having the fullest idea and having the best idea, sharing information in meetings, sharing information in publications, but certainly a good deal of healthy competition going on. As long as it's not too cutthroat and not too mean, I think this kind of competition actually fosters progress in the field rather than hampering it. So a certain amount of competition is probably healthy, but collaboration and cooperation is, of course, essential, and we do see that in the stem cell field as we see in other areas of biomedical research. However, if we look at the stem cell field internationally, here's what we have. We have a patchwork of ethical constraints and ethical allowances around the world. Whether or not the United States does human embryonic stem cell research, human embryonic stem cell research will be done in the world. If not here, in any one of a number of other countries. So we cannot prevent this kind of research from taking place. Here's what we can do. We can, by hobbling the research in inappropriate ways, we can consign the United States to a second, third, or fourth, or even lower ranked position in the world in this kind of research, in the technologies, in the biomedical advances, in the biotechnology companies that will flow from this research. We can assign the United States to a second-rate position, because we can be sure, looking around the world, that there are many other countries that are pursuing this sort of research with great vigor.
Is there an example historically of another line of scientific research or field of studying the sciences that's at all similar to this in terms of being so bound up with the ethical questions that are, as you say, differently perceived around the world?
Yes, we do have some recent lessons along this line, and what immediately comes to mind, of course, is recombinant DNA technology. Recombinant DNA technology was really invented in the 1970s, and it was invented by molecular biologists. One could single out one or two in particular. I won't do that this afternoon. Certainly the name Paul Berg comes strongly to mind. And what happened was the scientists who designed this technology called a meeting among themselves, and they said, look, what we're going to do is we're going to self-limit the kind of research we do. We're going to proscribe ourselves the kinds of things we do with recombinant DNA technology, because until we know more about the technology, until we understand potential hazards much better, there are certain kinds of experiments that we are not going to do. And of course, what we have seen since the 1970s in recombinant DNA technology is we've seen this technology gradually and increasingly broadly applied. We've learned that it is not a universally dangerous technology. Whole industries have come out of this technology. New approaches to asking questions about human health have come out of this technology. And what one hopes is that with stem cell research, the same thing will be true. We see the parallel in terms of what scientists themselves have done about the sort of stem cell research into cloning that we talked about earlier. Stem cell researchers themselves have decided here in the United States that they are not going to clone humans. Look, there are many states in the United States where it's not illegal to clone people, but you do not see stem cell researchers rushing to those states, setting up their laboratories to clone human beings. In fact, it is anathema to the stem cell research. And so you have this self-limiting by scientists, an imposition of an ethic within the field itself that bars certain unethical procedures.
Thank you. And stepping back just for a little bit to talk a little bit more specifically about research at Amherst. And could you just talk a little about the balance between being a researcher and pursuing your scientific work on that side, and then a teacher and a professor and a mentor for the students, and the balance not just for you, but the other faculty members here?
Here at Amherst, in departments like biology and chemistry and geology and the neurosciences, psychology, we don't really distinguish between research and teaching. We really don't. You can look at some of our classes in biology. If you look at genome biology, some of the research that Professor Hood, who teaches that course, does, some of the research that he does is actually done as laboratory exercises in the class. He tells his class, look, we're going to do this particular set of procedures on these organisms this afternoon. Nobody knows the genomics of these situations, and we're going to actually organize, and if necessary, we're going to, if it merits it, we're going to publish the research we get. So there you have a perfect marriage of teaching and research. So we don't really look at this dichotomy, which we see in many cases to be a false one, between teaching and research. We have the luxury here at Amherst College of being an institution that can actually afford to provide laboratories where our undergraduates can actually do real research. And we have gotten assurances from our president, from our board of directors, that this is a policy that we're going to continue here at Amherst College. So I'm really optimistic that this is a dichotomy that we won't have to face. I don't think anyone here at Amherst College faces a class of Amherst students without digging into the research literature on the areas that concern their teaching. You simply have to, because here at Amherst, you're facing a classroom of teachers, a classroom of students, and that's a Freudian slip, but it's a good slip, because one of the things I like about teaching here at Amherst is how much I learn from the students. I've been teaching for 40 years. I don't teach a single year here at Amherst that I don't learn a number of important things from my students. So you simply don't come up in front of a class of Amherst students, many of whom are reading in the literature of the field, some of whom are working in the literature of the field, some have worked in distinguished laboratories in the particular field you're talking about. You do not get up in front of students like that without having thoroughly researched in the research literature what's going on in your field. So I won't go on and on about this, but that's a false dichotomy for us.
Well, thank you. And I know our students are indeed lucky to be in these classrooms, and we thank you for transporting all of us on this call for an hour.
I'm certainly lucky to be in that classroom.
That's bringing us all back to the classroom for this last hour. It was a wonderful talk, and thank you.
Thank you for the privilege.
Enjoy your afternoon, all. Thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to signing on with you in another couple of months.